Section 3, Politics, Bourbons, and Tillmanites. As you read, look for attempts by the Bourbons or Redeemers to disfranchise black citizens. The Bourbons' policies regarding public education, property rights, the convict leasing system, and dueling. The rise of Ben Tillman and the agrarian populist movement. The creation of agricultural and mechanical colleges and the dispensary under Governor Tillman. How the new state constitution of 1895 helped legitimize the Jim Crow system. Terms: Redeemers, Bourbons, Disfranchise, Convict Lease System, Populism, Land Grants, Dispensary, Prohibition, Poll Tax, Segregation, Jim Crow System. At the end of Reconstruction in 1877, the men who took control were determined to undo radical Reconstruction and restore as much as possible of their antebellum South Carolina social and political systems. Most of them had been officers in the Confederate Army and thought they were the natural leaders who should control the state once more. As a group, they had several names. They usually referred to themselves as conservatives or conservative Democrats. Their contemporaries usually called them redeemers, because they were credited with redeeming the state from African American and Northern control. Historians often called them Bourbons because they acted like the French royal family of that name. After the French Revolution and the rule of Napoleon, the Bourbons tried to return France to the good old days. For South Carolina's Bourbons, the days before what they called the War of Northern Aggression were the good old days. The Bourbons had several basic beliefs. They believed in the supremacy of the white race, the Democratic Party, the cause of the Confederacy, states' rights, Protestant Christianity, and the horrors of Reconstruction. Beyond these beliefs, they had no strong agenda or programs that government should carry out. The Bourbons and African Americans. Wade Hampton III, who became governor after Reconstruction, was the trusted leader of the Bourbons. His reputation as a Confederate hero enabled him to establish a position on race that seemed moderate compared to the demands of more radical racists such as Martin Gary. Gary and his followers wanted to disfranchise, take away the vote from, blacks, and deprive them of other rights. Hampton promised President Rutherford B. Hayes and Northerners that blacks' rights would be protected under his care. Indeed, he appointed at least 86 black men to offices of state government. But he also told Northern audiences that the election of 1876 was a triumph for civilization, for home rule, for good government, for life itself. Hampton's comparatively moderate position on race was basically paternalistic. He believed the blacks would be better off leaving the governing to his better class of white people. They would protect blacks' interests better than blacks themselves could. Bourbons tried to control blacks' votes by promising them fair treatment, but making it harder for them to vote. They provided fewer polling places, official places to vote, in heavily black districts, requiring some blacks to travel nearly all day to and from the polls. The most effective means of reducing the black vote was the 8-box law, passed in 1882, long after Hampton left the governor's chair. The 8-box law was basically a literacy test. Each box was labeled for a different office that was up for election. The voter had to place his ballot for each office in the proper box, or it would not count. 82% of black voters could not read, and the white poll managers offered them no help in identifying boxes. Illiterate white voters, about 17%, could get help from the poll managers if they were going to vote Democratic. the managers would know how a person intended to vote because the secret ballot had not yet been adopted. The number and effectiveness of black votes declined drastically in the 1880s. Only in very heavily black districts could a few blacks and Republicans hope to get elected. Bourbon political issues. Hampton and the Bourbons continued to support the public education system for both blacks and whites in segregated schools that the Republicans had established during Reconstruction. They even increased the funding slightly. Under Hampton, almost equal amounts were spent per pupil for blacks and whites. By 1895, however, the state was spending three times as much per pupil for whites as blacks. Both systems were poorly supported, with the government pleading poverty. Hampton himself voted for federal aid to education in the Senate, but it never passed. His fellow senator, Matthew C. Butler, was opposed to federal aid. Butler argued that federal money would give the federal government too much influence in South Carolina schools. This argument governed South Carolina's position on federal aid to education until the 1960s. The Bourbon leaders were usually large landholders or people like Wade Hampton, who had been wealthy before the war. They tended to look after the rights and interests of property owners. An example was the fence law. One of the traditional privileges poor Carolinians had enjoyed since colonial days was the freedom to allow their livestock to roam freely and forage where they could. If landowners wanted to protect their crops, they had to build fences around them. In the 1880s, the Bourbons enabled counties to reverse that and require livestock owners to fence in their animals. The fence laws, passed by many counties, were seen as a conflict between the rich and the poor. The Bourbon regime was very frugal, not wasteful. One way to save money was to make the prisons pay for themselves. Under the convict lease system, the state leased prisoners to railroads, mining companies, plantations, and others. The businesses would house, feed, and discipline the prisoners, as well as force them to work. Most of the prisoners were black, and to many observers, it looked a lot like slavery by another name. To some, it seemed even worse than slavery because the companies had no financial investment in the worker. If a convict died or was crippled from a beating, the sheriff could provide another worker easily. An investigation at the time found that between 1877 and 1879, 51% of the prisoners leased to the Greenwood and Augusta Railroad died. South Carolina abolished the convict lease system in 1897. Shockingly, the practice continued in some other southern states until World War II. The ancient practice of dueling among men of the elite class came to an end under Bourbon rule. Perhaps the extreme violence of Civil War and Reconstruction took away some of the romantic appeal and illusion of nobility associated with the duel. In 1880, two prominent Carolinians, Colonel E. B. C. Cash and Colonel William Shannon, fought a duel in which Shannon died. Finally, Carolinians said, "Enough." In 1881, the legislature barred from public office anyone who had participated in a duel. Dueling ended, but violence as a means of settling disputes did not. The Bourbon governors and legislatures from 1877 to 1890 were not very active in economic affairs. They did establish the South Carolina Agricultural Bureau, which provided information and advice to farmers concerning crops and seeds, weather, and new techniques. The Bourbons welcomed industries others created, but offered little encouragement. The state government responded to the many complaints about unfair railroad practices and rates by establishing the Railroad Commission. The commission could investigate, but it was given little power to regulate the railroad systems or their rates. Several other states, especially in the Midwest, were much more active in protecting consumers from unfair railroad practices. The federal government, with its policy of laissez-faire, usually stayed out of the practices of large corporations except to help them. But in 1887, Congress established the Interstate Commerce Commission to try to regulate railroads and prevent practices that were unfair to their customers. This first regulatory commission set a pattern followed by the many other commissions the federal government was to establish in the 20th century. Ben Tillman challenges the Bourbons. Benjamin Ryan Tillman of Edgefield County had been a younger associate of Martin Gary in planning the Red Shirt Campaign of 1876. They claimed by their use of election fraud, intimidation, and violence to have redeemed the state from Republican control and placed Wade Hampton in the governor's office. Once the Bourbons were in power, both Gary and Tillman quickly became disillusioned with them. Gary died in 1881, and Tillman held back for several years while building his farming operation until he owned over 2,000 acres. Thus, he was in the same economic class as most of the Bourbon leaders, but he considered himself a real farmer and the Bourbons merely politicians. Ben Tillman's entry into politics. Tillman sprang onto the political stage with an emotional speech to the State Agricultural and Mechanical Society in Bennettsville in 1885. He declared that farmers were poorer than they had been at the end of the war in 1865, and blamed this on the Bourbons, who had abandoned the real farmers. The state needed an agricultural college, but the South Carolina College, USC, was a school for elite dandies producing helpless beings, and the Citadel was merely a dude factory. Tillman was bold, colorful, and electrifying. He had lost an eye to infection in his youth. As a speaker, he raged across the stage, glaring at the audience with his one flashing eye, holding the farmers spellbound. Ill health had kept him out of the Confederate Army. He was a self-educated man who read widely but never went to college. His personality and politics made him one of South Carolina's most influential leaders. Tillman organized a new farmers' association that attacked the Bourbons and advocated agricultural experiment stations and a real agricultural college. The rise of agrarian populism. The Tillman movement in South Carolina was part of a national agrarian, farmer or agricultural, movement known as populism. Agrarian populism became strong in the 1880s and 1890s, especially in the South and the Midwest. Populism is not easy to define, but usually involves pitting the common people against an economic or political elite. Populists use a folksy appeal to people's common sense, not to their intellect. This approach involved more people in the political process, but it often led to demagoguery, praising the virtues of the people while appealing to people's fear, hate, and prejudice. Farmers protested low prices for their farm products, high railroad rates, high machinery cost, and unresponsive state and national governments. They formed a new political party, the Populist or People's Party. The Populists wanted strict regulation of railroads, government loans for farmers, an 8-hour factory workday, and an expanded money supply. They proposed a graduated income tax that required wealthy people to pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes. Tillman was unwilling to accept the more radical proposals. Populists in some states, such as Georgia, formed a coalition of white and black poor farmers to demand reforms. But for Tillman, maintaining white unity and superiority was more important than any reforms. He chose not to break with the party of the Bourbons, but to capture it. he wanted to keep South Carolina a Democratic state in a solid Democratic South, believing it was the only way to maintain white control. Governor Ben Tillman. Tillman claimed no political ambitions, but he built the Farmers Association into a powerful political machine. Superior organization and inspiring stump speeches enabled him to take over the Democratic Party in 1890 and become its candidate for governor. Even Wade Hampton had to support the man who had so savagely attacked him and his kind. Hampton, too, believed the unity of Democrats was necessary for the survival of white supremacy in a state that was 60% black. A former Bourbon leader, A. C. Haskell, ran as an independent and sought black votes. It was no contest. Democrats won the statewide offices as they always had since 1876 and always would until the 1970s. The Tillmanite reformers were in, and the Bourbons were out. But Tillman offered no grand reforms, no sweeping changes in economic policy that would help the farmers he had championed so strongly. Tillmanites got only a slight change in the tax code that helped small farmers and required corporations to pay a bit more. The legislature limited the work week in cotton mills to 66 hours, giving workers a few more leisure hours on Saturdays. Tillman also got more funding and better organization for the insane asylum. He bullied the General Assembly into giving fewer representatives to Charleston and more to the upcountry. Representation in state government was, at last, proportionate to population. Creation of agricultural and mechanical colleges. Tillman's signature issue in his rise to power was agricultural education and the creation of an agricultural college. Bourbons feared that founding an agricultural college would take away funds from their favorite institution, South Carolina College, USC. By the time he was elected governor, the General Assembly, prodded by Tillman, had authorized creation of Clemson Agricultural College. Tillman's friend and ally, Thomas G. Clemson, son-in-law of John C. Calhoun, had died in 1888 and left Calhoun's Fort Hill Plantation and some money to the state for establishing the new college in Oconee County. South Carolina received additional land grant funds from the federal government. Land grants were funds set aside from the sale of lands in the West to support agricultural and mechanical colleges. The college began operations in 1893 with 446 students, the largest college in the state. In 1891, the Tillmanites created Winthrop Normal and Industrial College of South Carolina to educate young women. This successor to an older Winthrop training school for teachers in Columbia moved to Rock Hill in 1895. Tillman also supported the creation in 1896 of an all-black land-grant college in Orangeburg that is now known as South Carolina State University. The Dispensary. A more controversial accomplishment was Tillman's creation in 1892 of the dispensary, a state monopoly on the sale of liquor. The people had voted in a referendum for prohibition, the outlawing of all alcoholic beverages. Instead, Tillman's state government took over sale and distribution of all liquor. The dispensary greatly expanded the governor's patronage power, that is, the power to appoint numerous friends and allies to state jobs. Hundreds of constables were appointed to enforce the law. Constables angered many people as they closed saloons and searched for illegal liquor. Resistance to them came to a head in Darlington in 1893, when two citizens and a constable were killed in a gunfight, and a mob chased the remaining constables into the surrounding woods. Tillman ordered militia units to Darlington to restore order and enforce the law. Units from several towns, including Columbia, refused to go. Then the governor called upon units from his loyal rural communities. They rallied, some units protecting the governor and the dispensary in Columbia, and others restoring order in Darlington. Tilghman's decisive action strengthened his authority and his reputation as governor. The state was never quite able to close down all the illegal saloons known as Blind Tigers. The dispensary became a big moneymaker for the state government, but the source of a great deal of corruption. In 1907, the General Assembly closed down the state system, but allowed counties to continue local systems. Several counties continued the system, but the state and the nation were moving toward an experiment in prohibition, which began in South Carolina by 1915 and in the nation in 1920. A new state constitution. Tilghman moved on to the U.S. Senate by the end of his term in 1894, but his influence in state politics and policy continued for many years. He died as a senator in 1918. One of Tilghman's lasting legacies was the new state constitution, which he had a major hand in creating in 1895. According to Tilghman, the main reason for writing his new constitution was to officially and legally take away the right of black citizens to vote. Because the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution protected the right of citizens to vote without regard to race, the new South Carolina Constitution could not say, "No black man shall vote." Other means had to be found. The most effective method for preventing blacks from voting was the literacy requirement. Most blacks were still illiterate in the 1890s. Quite a number of whites were illiterate also, but white voter registrars registered them anyway. A black man who could read and write found it difficult to convince the white registrar that he was literate. Another method used to reduce black voting was the poll tax, a tax each voter was required to pay before he could cast a ballot. Most blacks were poor, and paying the tax was a burden. Soon the number of blacks voting in the whole state was only a few hundred. Literacy requirements and poll taxes as means of disfranchising African American voters were approved by the U.S. Supreme Court in a unanimous decision, Williams v. Mississippi, in 1898. The decision seemed to reflect the consensus of the majority of white Americans, North and South, that non-white peoples were inferior to whites. Scientific studies of the time had seemed to justify whites' prejudice and discrimination against other racial groups. That scientific research that placed blacks on a lower level of evolutionary development than whites was totally disproven by scientists in the 20th century. The new Constitution forbade interracial marriage and carefully defined a black person as anyone with at least 1/8 or more of Negro blood, that is, at least one great-grandparent of African descent. In addition to virtually excluding African American citizens from voting, the new Constitution, of course, continued to totally exclude women from voting. Incidentally, to serve on a jury, one had to be a registered voter, so no women and few black men were eligible to serve on juries. One of the immediate effects of black disfranchisement was the defeat of Congressman George Washington Murray for re-election in 1896 in a largely black district. Murray was the last African American to serve in the Congress from South Carolina until the election of James Clyburn in 1993. The long-term effect was to leave African Americans almost without the protection of law. They were certainly without the equal protection of the law promised in the 14th Amendment. Tilghman's Constitution also required separate schools for blacks and whites. Segregation, separation of the races, in most public functions had been generally customary since emancipation. In the 1890s, the separation became more formal, legally required, and rigidly enforced. The pattern of segregation and discrimination that developed in the 1890s is usually referred to as the Jim Crow system. The origin of the term is uncertain. Segregated schools and public facilities of all sorts were approved by the U.S. Supreme Court in a Louisiana case, Plessy v. Ferguson, in 1896. The system of Jim Crow. Under Jim Crow, black and white citizens learned the etiquette that was to govern their contacts with people of the opposite race for the next several decades. Black people would never call white adults by their first name, Miss for female, or Master, Massa, Boss, or his military rank for a male were required. White people could call black persons by their first names, no matter what their age. Those who were elderly or well-liked might be called uncle or auntie. Black people had to yield the sidewalk to whites and let them pass. Restaurants were to be for either whites or blacks, never for both. Doctors' offices and train depots had separate waiting rooms, and trains had separate cars for the two races. If a theater admitted blacks at all, it provided a separate seating section, usually in the balcony. A black person would never approach a white family's house from the front. The back door was the only proper entrance for black servants or repair persons who were likely to be the only blacks admitted. A black man would be in danger if he touched a white woman or looked directly at her. He had to avert his eyes, look away, to show proper respect. To be suspected of improperly relating to a white woman was the easiest way for a black man to be lynched. Under Tillman and his successors, the number of lynchings increased. Tillman declared he would lead the mob himself against an accused assaulter of a white woman. There was no such outrage over the assault of a black woman by a white man, which had been much more common both during slavery and since emancipation. Racial violence has been a constant in South Carolina history. It grew more intense in the Tillman era than in the Bourbon era, in part because of the racially loaded language of the leader. Lynching was only part of that violent picture. Race riots were another. In Phoenix, in Greenwood County, a riot broke out on Election Day, 1898, between white Democrats and white and black Republicans. The white Republicans were trying to collect evidence of Democrats preventing blacks from voting. A white Democrat was killed in the fighting. Over the next few days, several black men were killed and two white Republicans' houses were burned. Many white people of South Carolina disapproved of the violence, but most whites accepted it as being necessary to maintain white supremacy. Violence had been the foundation for the system of slavery. Violence had been one of the means of overthrowing the biracial democracy of Reconstruction. Violence, or the threat of it, was to be the means for enforcing black disfranchisement, racial segregation, and inequality, the system of Jim Crow, during the Bourbon and Tillman eras and throughout much of the 20th century. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form, disfranchise, convict lease system, land grants. 2. Why were conservative Democrats of the late 19th century called Bourbons? 3. What were some of the aims of the Populist or People's Party? The following is a summary of Chapter 11. During the decades after the end of the Civil War, the United States started moving toward greater industrialization. Industrial growth was more evident in the northeast region of the United States, although there was some industry in the South. In South Carolina, a new textile industry emerged, but South Carolina remained essentially an agricultural state. The Democratic Party in South Carolina worked hard to regain control of the government once Reconstruction ended. That meant that nothing much had changed for blacks and poor whites in the state. Neither group would have much voice in the government. Black people found themselves living under restrictions imposed by Jim Crow. The leading politician in South Carolina during the 1880s and 1890s was Benjamin Tillman, who supported the creation of separate agricultural colleges for black and white farmers. Tillman was also responsible for the 1895 state constitution for South Carolina. The turn of the 20th century saw the emergence of the United States as a world power. It not only had made great strides in industry, but it also gained colonies and influence in the Pacific and the Caribbean. The United States was certainly showing that it could compete in a global setting.